Hi there. Come up on the porch. We're just sitting here watching it rain and talking about Louisiana. I'm Bruce McGee.
And I'm Steve Payne.
And this is the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, episode 190 for January 7th, 2017.
Welcome back.
And Happy New Year.
Yes, the new year has arrived.
That's it. Hope it's a good one for you. This week we complete our interview with Nancy Dixon about her New Orleans anthology, N.O.Lit, 200 Years of New Orleans Literature. Mm-hmm. It's a collection of short fiction and plays that reflect the city's literary history from Paul Louis LeBlanc de Villeneuve. Is that how you say that?
Villeneuve.
Oh, and she's got a English version of the Festival of the Young Corn. That's good.
Mm-hmm. That's the really old Native American
story. Yeah, it's an old Native American story, and it's the first French language play in Louisiana, therefore the first play written about Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. And it taps into a larger cultural ritual of Native Americans, mm-hmm. and you know, in the Mid-South and over in the Southeast too. I mean, apparently there
the
was
new
a,
corn festival.
Yes, it's a really ancient festival
or feast, or whatever.
Know, I guess it's like a. And it's not a harvest festival at all. I guess is it?
Well, I guess it's early harvest, like the green corn is.
Maybe so.
New corn is when it's sweet in the field, and so yeah, it's early. I mean, it comes in early, so it's mm-hmm. a harvest festival.
So it is a
July,
type of
harvest
festival,
right?
But it is an important part of Native American culture,
right? Apparently, we learned that through this project. So, and plus, it's nice talking to somebody else that's done a project not totally unlike ours.
Right, it's got a similar thrust.
When we've stumbled across some of the same authors mm-hmm. in our search for texts. All right, now this week in Louisiana history.
So this week in Louisiana history, on January 3rd, 1842, New Orleans' first two primary schools, one for boys and one for girls, opened on Julia Street.
So would these be public schools?
I don't know the history of those things.
It doesn't say. It says primary, but apparently not parochial, because those had been around, you know.
But the Ursulines.
Ursulines Girls' School goes back to the 1700s.
Was there a boys' school like that?
I don't know. I think the Jesuits may have run
one. Makes sense. Because they, of course, run Loyola. Yeah.
Right. And the Jesuits were closely aligned with the Ursulines as educators.
They're strong on education.
Mm-hmm. All right. This week in New Orleans history, George Adrian Paletti is born on January 2nd, 1867. Paletti headed up the French Opera House for 25 years during the winters and toured with Liberty's band during the summers. So he was a busy fellow. Now for this week in Louisiana.
So this week in Louisiana, Rocky's Cajun Kitchen and Eunice will host what?
Is this live just Cajun French
okay.
music.
Is this a festival?
No, it's
okay.
every week.
Okay. So this is every week. They offer live Cajun music on Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday nights. Bring the whole family and enjoy the true Cajun tradition with us. All-you-can-eat seafood buffet on Friday and Saturday for $25.99. Includes shrimp etouffee, seafood gumbo, fried fish, fried shrimp, fried oysters, frog legs, jalapeno hush puppies, french fries, at corn nuggets, boiled shrimp with potatoes and corn, snow crab legs, baked fish, and more.
Sounds
as though
good.
There could be more.
Love me some frog legs. I like those frog legs. All right, well, so go down to 1415 East Laurel Avenue in Eunice and make sure you come hungry
mm-hmm.
and ready to hear some good Cajun music.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been very cold this week, and we're going to go back to a postcard from New Orleans. It's at the Pepper Palace to warm us up a little bit in this cold weather. All right, so I am here in the Pepper Palace, and you are?
Caitlin,
and you're running the place?
I am, for tonight.
For tonight. What time do y'all close?
I will close at 10.
And what's your address, for the address of this?
835 Decatur.
Decatur?
Decatur Street, yes, sir.
All right, and so it's right across the street, like if you walk past the Café du Monde, going down the street on the left side, It's about halfway down that block. And I've always looked at this place and never come in. So you're telling me about your Louisiana hot sauces.
Yes, we have the Bayou ones. We have the Bayou Fireball, Bayou Blowtorch, and the Bayou Cajun Fire. And we also have the Gator Hammock, which is a really good one. And then the Panolas are also our Louisiana ones. But the cool thing about our store is if you come up here on our sample bar...
Yeah, I see you've got samples. Hey, can I get a picture?
Yeah, of course.
Like, oh my God. Well, yeah, stand by there. Oh my God, look at all these. The sample bar is 2, 4, 6, 8, about 10 times 1, 2. I don't know what, 70, 80 different spices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's hundreds of different spices and hot sauces on the sample bar itself when it comes to everything when you break it down. But the good thing about our store is we are a chain, but from here, so about, I'd say about a third of the bar is the Louisiana-inspired flavors.
You can so there are more of these in other parts of the country?
There are, yeah. They're all over, and there's some in Canada as well.
Wow, I would have never thought. I thought this was a total Louisiana...
No, unfortunately not. But the good thing about the company is they do cater to each individual store.
Well, and they know Louisiana is big on its spices.
Definitely,
so you aren't going to do many sales if you don't have Louisiana stuff.
Exactly. So these are all of our Louisiana ones, and we have about 30 of them, give or take.
Now, is this a Louisiana?
It is not. So from here, the bad to the bone.
Ah,
all the way.
Bad to the bone, of course.
Yes. So we have a good bit of variety, and we have some more on the wall here that are some Louisiana-inspired flavors.
Now, full disclosure, you've already admitted that y'all don't have Tabasco because they've got their own store. But you've got Louisiana hot sauce.
We do. A good bit to choose from. And a variety of heat levels, too. It goes from 2 to 10. So, and we put Tabasco at about a 4. So you have a lot of options when it comes to your heat.
Do you have any that aren't vinegar-based?
We have a few that are tomato-based and a few that are mustard.
Because I've never liked, personally, the vinegar-based hot sauces. I know it's heresy in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, when I was growing up, my mom would grow a pepper bush in the yard and pick the peppers off and just stick them into a bottle and pour vinegar over them. So I grew up with that stuff, but I never liked it.
That's unfortunate, but we do have a good bit. Our Jean Lafitte right here has vinegar in it, but it's more of a tomato base. And then we also
I try that one?
Yeah, please. It is a 9 out of 10, so it's a little spicy. Ooh.
So it's a pirate of hot sauces.
Yeah. And we actually have this one, too. It's carrot-based, which is fun.
Which is what based?
Carrot-based.
Oh, wow. I'm going to have to try that. Where's my water? Okay, so I've tried the Jean Lafitte. It's very hot.
It is hot.
But not, like, I'm not crying. How red am I?
Not that red, to be honest with you. But
I was already sweating when I came in here, so it's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah, the flavor and the heat combine really well in that one, which is why it's our best seller, actually.
I kind of like that one. I tried the carrot one, and it didn't have the...
it's not as robust.
The vinegar, but the mix of... Like the blend of peppers, I didn't really care for that much.
I'm a fan of that one. The Cajun Ghost, it's not really, it has vinegar in it, but it does have a lot of flavor. This one is.
Let me try Cajun Ghost.
Cajun Ghost. I'm gonna let you guess what pepper that one has in it.
Cayenne.
Raw.
What does it have?
Ghost pepper.
Really? I didn't know there was such a thing.
Mm-hmm. Third hottest pepper.
Okay, then this one's almost like a hot barbecue sauce.
Kind of.
I think that's my favorite so far.
That one?
Yeah.
Got a good palate. Yeah, I like that one too.
Because it's that barbecue sauce instead of vinegar overpowering or, you know, it's because you get a balanced recipe.
Right.
That just needs some heat. Mm-hmm. Now, I usually go cayenne, pepper, you know, just
straight up.
Shake it. Yeah.
Well, do you like the barbecue vibe?
I love the Cajun Ghost. That's my favorite so far.
This one is our, it's a historic St. Charles. It's actually a smoked apple barbecue.
Ooh.
Yeah. So it's a little sweeter, a little tangier.
You know I'm working right now. You are. I'm not getting paid, but... Well, I mean, specifically for this. Right. So. Yeah, it's got a little sweet.
It is sweet. So that's where the apple comes in at.
Mm-hmm. Where do they make this?
Sierraville, Tennessee.
Oh.
I know, it's unfortunate.
What about Cajun Ghost?
All of the Pepper Palace ones are bottled in Tennessee, but like I said, these are manufactured just for us.
Okay.
Like, you can't go to any other Pepper Palace and get these flavors. Oh,
wow.
Which is really cool.
Those are my two favorite, Cajun Ghost, and I might get one of each.
Yeah, if you buy any five items, you get one free, which we're always running that store special, so...
Okay, so buy five, get one free, and how much is each bottle?
They're all different prices. The hotter you go, the more they do cost, but they range from anywhere as low as $6.95 all the way up to $29.95 for some of our hotter ones. Yeah.
Wow, how much are these?
$15.95.
Okay. Might stick with two.
Yeah, no worries. Of course, of course.
These I'm a professor.
These two are $15, and then this one's $10.95.
Mm. I really like the apple one.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good on barbecue.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. You could use this as barbecue.
That
well,
one's a really good marinade. The Cajun Ghost is a really good marinade.
So you're from New Orleans?
I am.
What part of town?
I'm actually from Lakeview.
Where is that? Out near the lake?
Closer to Metairie, yeah.
Is that past Bucktown?
Right in the middle of Bucktown and Mid City.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been to Bucktown to eat before. Deanie's, of course.
Food. They got some good food.
The original Deanie's.
Yeah, right there by the market.
And you cook?
Do I cook? Yeah, of course I cook working
here. Of course.
But we do have some pretty cool seasonings too. That a little bit.
Oh yeah, show me your shake seasonings.
Yeah, right up here. One item in the store that you would have to get, it would be this French Quarter Creole seasoning.
Y'all sample that too, or?
Yeah, of course. This all the front rows are all the samples.
Oh, okay.
This one's phenomenal. Very versatile. Very distinct, though. Distinct to that New Orleans flavor.
Okay, I might get one of those. How much is it?
$9.95. And our seasonings average around $9.95.
Actually, I use a lot of Tony's, but I like to try other things. I found a mix I like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 2 teaspoons of salt, onion, garlic powder, and then 1 teaspoon each of black pepper, white pepper, red pepper. Real simple,
yeah,
but it tastes really good.
Really good. We have this one that's kind of similar to that one. It's the Big Easy. It's kind of more of a seasoned salt, though, I'm not going to lie. But it's really versatile as well.
Yeah, well, Tony, you know, and this one does like that, too. When it's salty enough, then it's right. Oh, man, y'all are just grooving to the 80s
yeah,
tonight.
Yeah, always. All day.
Do you have it on a loop?
Yeah, we have a playlist in the back. We actually have a Spotify account that has all of our music on it, which is pretty cool.
So is it enough you don't get sick of the same...
I don't think that's ever going to be the case when you work in one place for 40 hours a week.
Right. I used to work at a Piggly Wiggly. This is the 8-track 70s.
Oh.
It can get, what, like 10 you know, songs on it. And the person that ran it, her favorite... tape that should run all day was Elvis Blue Christmas.
Oh no, we have one Elvis song on here and I'm just it's bad. So are you trying it? Yes, go for it. Take it to the
head. Now on to our interview with Nancy Dixon.
So did you put any cable in your book?
I do. I have Tipulette.
Yeah. And
then I have Charles Taillet's Mr. Cable's Friedman Case in Equity, and then I have Cable's Friedman's Case in Equity. So I have Cable's and I have Taillet's response. And one of the great things about Charles Guy's response is talking about what a horrible writer Cable is.
Well, Cable was run off from New Orleans for his overly liberal ideas on
I mean, he chose to leave, but he was given an offer he couldn't refuse. For
yeah, well, they were also making him an offer in New Orleans itself. So why don't you leave? But I think that's why he is still not really part of our canon as far as, you know, like, I don't remember him from grad school. I don't know. Did you have a class where they taught Cable?
I did. That's where I read the Grandissime, in fact, first time.
Well, that's
in grad
good.
School.
Mm-hmm. That may be a South Louisiana thing, because we've got a guy who is on the library staff at Tech, and he's a UNO and LSU graduate. But anyhow, I want to say he's undergraduate either from UNO or Tulane, one of the two. And he was telling me that when he was a kid, they read Cable in his high school. I think he went to a Catholic high school in New Orleans, mm-hmm. and then he went to college. Now, I know he went to college there for sure, and he was saying that they read some Cable when he was in college as well. So evidently,
yeah, we do read him here. Yeah,
so whoever his professor was evidently had a liking for Cable's fiction.
Right. And
I wonder if it was me.
He's my age, so it's unlikely. I mean, you and I are probably pretty close to the same age, so he's like my age, maybe a year or so younger, so I kind of doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would have been at UNO or Tulane like back in the early 80s.
No, you're right.
you
were
still
on the street.
That's right.
Well, I'm curious about this. How does New Orleans, and this is a kind of a complicated question even to ask, much less to answer, but how does New Orleans figure as setting and as character and as symbol in the book? Because it can be all three.
Well, and I talk about that. I talk about the sort of isolationism of the city in every
right.
way, you know, back then, and also, you know, that we saw in Katrina,
right.
that we're in this on our own. I mean, I don't care, you know, when you have Hastert, you know, telling us why we have New Orleans anyway. I mean, of course, he got his comeuppance city knowledge.
Yeah,
yes,
boy.
He did.
But, you know, that, and then
they always do.
I know it. And they have the, you know, and then we have the Isleños who are completely separated. So we have this weird, one of the reasons that our literature is so rich is because we weren't, you know, we were here as a small colony in this city, really.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't, I mean, and people came, and I have the people that came and went, you know, but
right.
I also have the ones who stayed. I mean, I have the Whitman and the, and the Sherwood Anderson and the William Faulkner, but
right,
you know, we had already established a really rich culture, because this was a pretty cultured society that moved here in the Spanish and French that came here.
Mm-hmm. You know, the American authors that moved to New Orleans did so for very similar reasons for the American authors who moved to Paris. It's because it was
truth.
A very place.
It was cheap. It was fun. It was a lot of drinking and sex and food and carrying on. And, you know, they
well, it was eccentric,
here.
Too. And it takes a certain eccentricity to be a fiction writer, frankly.
That's right. Well, that's what William said. You know, he said that it provided him with this certain, you know, the necessary conflict, the necessary sort of, you know, creative tension of, you know, the Catholicism and
right.
The debauchery in the French Quarter, because, you know, there's Jackson Square, you know, the cathedral right there in the heart of the quarter, but boy, can't you bar the door when you walk behind that cathedral.
Right. Oh, yeah. And, you know, the exoticism that you can write about a culture that's so totally different, and that attracts readers. You know, they're interested in a place like New Orleans. How is this America, and how, you know, if this is America, where are we?
And the race. I mean, the race, the mixing of the races, racism,
right.
slavery, all of that, the castes that we had in this city. We had more names for mixed breeds of
right.
mixed race people and children than any place in the nation, and I mean, you know, my students never heard of griffe. You know, they don't know. what mm-hmm. I'm talking about.
How about quadroon and octoroon? Is that
yeah,
still?
They know that.
Okay.
They do know that. Some of them never heard of, you know, the octoroon balls and the quadroon balls and. You know, they're, you know, especially at Dillard, they're well aware of race and skin color and the opportunity that light skin still often
right.
affords people of color. And,
right.
So, it's historically so, and they get that and how times are kind of changing. I mean, we look at TV, we look at ads, we look at actresses. And you can see in actors, and you can see darker skinned people, you know, and it's all part of the Black Lives Matter and
right.
racist. It's all, you know, they're pretty astute when it comes to that. So,
I'm curious about a large South European ethnic community that was there, and it's supposedly one of the oldest in the United States is the Italian community there. Do you represent any Italian writers? I mean, one of my aunts was Italian too, so I'm just curious. Are there any Italian writers represented in the
Hamilton Basso?
Okay,
is about the only ones he writes about. It's an article of his that appeared in the New Yorker called "New Orleans Childhood: The House on Decatur Street," and I put that in there. Even some of his fiction was better, but this one is so good because he writes about the Italian community.
Oh, yeah.
His grandfather was an Italian shoemaker.
Oh, wow.
On the street. And he went on to New York and became a big and really rich publisher. And then The View from Pompeii's Head that he wrote was a bestseller forever. No one reads that book anymore.
Right.
And it made him a lot of money. But he loved coming down to New Orleans, and he loved coming back home. But he also writes about Bourbon Street and how it was always kind of a funky street.
And, right, right.
You know, his dentist was on Bourbon Street, and this is back in the 20s, you know. And he's talking about.
Well, so and you said his grandfather was a shoemaker, so he probably
yeah, he
must
was.
Have come in there way into the 19th century sometime, like 1870s,
yeah,
1880s.
Yeah. Yeah, late 19th century, yeah. And I worked at Johnny Matassa's bar, and Matassa came, it was a Sicilian that came over back then, too. And then Cosmo Matassa was his grandson, grandson. And you know, the music producer. And but Matassa owned, at one point, Johnny Matassa owned more property than anybody in the French Quarter, or this Italian, you know, the Sicilian. So single property owner. But you know, the Italians, as you know, were big in the Quarter.
Right.
Well, I've just finished a novel, actually, set in early 1930s New Orleans. It's set right at the tail end of Prohibition.
Which one?
Well, this novel that I've just finished writing, and it's and I'm hoping for a December, maybe Christmas publication date of this year. I'm not really for sure, but anyhow, about five. Bruce has a copy of it, and four other people have copies of the manuscript. And it's a crime novel, and it's new pulp fiction is what it is. But it's set during the last days of Prohibition. For a reason, primarily because Prohibition never worked in New Orleans. I mean, we know that's a fact. It's a joke. It was a joke on the Gulf Coast, but particularly around the New Orleans and Baton Rouge areas, because it was just so easy. It was easy to smuggle liquor in.
They didn't even have to have speakeasies. They just drank.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the famous restaurant down there, Arno's, had these secret dining rooms that you could go in and, you know, just drink to your heart's content.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. They just drank. But I look forward to reading it. Who's publishing it?
We're a little small house out of Massachusetts called Altus Press, but I think what their claim to fame is two things right now. They've reissued, or I say reissued, they're writing new, I know the guy, the old pulp Superman precursor Doc Savage. They're actually publishing those things. These are new novels featuring Doc Savage, the Man of Bronze.
Wow.
And as I said, I know that guy personally. I don't know him really well, but I do know him. And they've done the first new Tarzan novel in quite a long time.
Wow.
And that same guy that writes the Doc novels, Will Murray, he actually has written this Tarzan thing too. So Will and I and another, my original publisher, are the three, you know, people that do the new fiction for him. And then they do a bunch of reprint stuff too.
That's great.
A whole bunch of reprint stuff. But yeah, he's you know, he's going to be bringing this out in December, this Altus Press, and so hopefully we'll see this
That's
thing
great.
Come rolling out about that time. So, and a lot of the crackdown of the novel takes place down below New Orleans in one of those old War of 1812 era forts.
Mm.
A big shootout goes on in the fort, and a gas attack and everything else. So they're using a lot of old World War One ordnance that's left over. It's some pretty horrific stuff, actually, that they're using to kill people.
I look forward to reading it.
So, are you familiar with 19th century? Catherine Cole is a woman writer.
Yeah, from my work on Sally Rep Roman. I'm familiar with Catherine Cole, and a friend of mine, you should talk to him, in fact, his name is Joseph Makos, and he bought the entire Times-Picayune paper, newspaper, daily newspapers from 1887 to 1928 or something, and he had...
Wow.
Yeah.
And what's his last name again? We'll need to contact this guy.
Makos. Yeah, you do.
How do you spell the last name?
M-A-K-M-A-K-K-O-S.
Oh, okay, Makos. Yeah, because, you know, she wrote, she was unusual in being a female journalist.
Mm-hmm.
But she also, she wrote, like, postcards from all the parishes. I don't know how many parishes they had at the time, but she went to every parish in the state and wrote about that parish. And it
little travel logs.
Right.
It was published, I think it was both the Picayune and the Times, because they were separate papers back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and she was their first woman reporter, I think, was she not? Or the first full-time woman reporter or something. I mean, she's a real historical figure, I think.
Well, Poitevin Nicholson, she's the one that hired women. I mean, she said, I want women reporters. I mean, she wanted women working for her.
And she was something of a star because of that series, you know, people. And I understand that maybe it was the Picayune that sent out a Saturday paper all over the state by mail, and people all over the state read it. And, of course, they wanted to read about themselves in those accounts of the various parishes, so she was good for circulation.
Yeah, and at one point the Picayune had the highest circulation of any Sunday newspaper for sure in the South.
I'm reading the Oxford New American Dictionary entry for Nellie Bly, another early female journalist, and that probably, if you look at how few women were working in that profession at that time, this probably was not just a feminist sort of a thing to be hiring another woman, but probably they thought it would be a novel sort of a thing to hire a woman, quite frankly. That this enable, you know, in other words, if we hire this woman, it enables us to go head-to-head with some big city newspapers and ups our respect in the eyes of other people, maybe.
Well, maybe so. I mean, Sally Rhett Roman, when she wrote editorials, at first for the Times, she couldn't use her real name. She just used her initials. But as soon as she started writing fiction, she used her full name.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also, coincidentally, after her husband passed.
Well, and you have a bunch of women writers who write fiction. Was it Della Hussey? She wrote the Quadroon or the Quadroon? I think it was in French.
She wrote. I just read that recently. Translation, but
do they have a translation?
Mm-hmm. And I have, you know, in the middle of, oddly enough, in the middle of my anthology in the late 1800s, early 1900s, most of the writers are women. The you know, Mary Ashley Townsend and Eliza Nicholson and Sally Roman and Rutha Kennery Stewart, Kate Chopin, Grace King, Molly Moore. You know, they were it was a big time for women fiction writers.
It really was.
It was.
Yes. Chopin was in and out of New Orleans.
She lived here till she moved up to her husband's plantation, and then he died not long after. and then she moved back to St. Louis.
I was going to say,
right.
Wasn't she a Missourian originally,
yeah.
or at least had lived
That's
there?
That's where they met, yeah. But she lived, her last house was up on Louisiana Avenue, and there's not a plaque or anything. I should work to do something about that.
Cloutierville, wasn't it, her husband's?
Yeah, Cloutierville, yep. Mm-hmm.
And Stephen and I had just started the project, and I was looking. We've been trying to find stuff in North Louisiana because it's so overlooked, and
mm-hmm.
so I found out I was going to Alexandria a lot, and I found out, oh, there's a Kate Chopin house 30 miles from here. And I was all excited, planning a trip. And about the third link I clicked on to find out more information was a video of the house burning.
Oh, shoot.
I was so depressed. Yeah. I had looked at this was 10 o'clock right before bedtime. I literally could not sleep. I was so upset. And
that is upsetting. Well, Lyle Saxon was, he wrote up there.
Yeah, he was in the Natchitoches area, I think.
Yeah, uh-huh. And he wrote the Cane River.
Yeah.
That's where he went up there to write.
He was doing that Federal Writers Project, wasn't it, or something like that?
He was doing that here. And he did that mostly here. Most of his fiction writing went on up there at that plantation. It's famous, but it's eluding me right now.
It's right in the Natchitoches area.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he wrote the Cane River trilogy or something. And that's all about the Cane River up in there. Where my dad is.
The one he did in New Orleans was Gumbo Yaya, right?
Right.
Yeah, well, I don't think we're ever going to get that digitized because it's in such a mess. But if we do, it'll be a big one.
We've got these North Louisiana writers, but a lot of them are more contemporary, like Robert Harling that wrote Steel Magnolias. I mean, he's from Natchitoches, you know.
Yeah.
But that's a matter. There we think about people like you that are getting grants. It's a matter of getting grants to buy a license to use those things. And then you have to negotiate with their publisher or their agent, this, that, and the other, and it winds up getting pretty prohibitive in terms of the cost.
Well, ours was kind of a problem we had, but everybody was really, really nice and giving and generous, except for a few who remain unnamed. And then we never could find Lillian Hellman.
Hmm.
We never could get to the bottom of it. I mean, it was holding us up because we had toys in the attic, and I just let it go. Just let it go. And my husband was mad because it was, you know, 40 pages.
Oh, you mean you couldn't find the copyright holder?
Couldn't find a copyright holder, couldn't find the lawyers, the estate. I mean, it's esoteric wherever it is. I even taught the play with that new dramatic series, those little plays that are all, you know, in the same sort of cover. But we couldn't find it. And we didn't have to pay that much, though. I mean, it really was a nominal fee, but we can't, that's not for online.
Right.
This anthology is not online for that reason.
Right. You have to make that kind of choice, like, you know, that's sort of when you're starting, you have to choose, okay, what media is this going to come through anymore? Because back in the day, it was print copy and that was it. But, you know, we have so many options at this point. If you look at our dateline, we have a lot of stuff that was written in the 1700s, 1800s, early 1900s. Mm-hmm. Then it falls off a cliff.
Because we can't afford licenses.
Yeah, well, I understand. I get it.
Not just that. It's people dying. Who is the who is the estate? Who runs the estate? Who would you
the heirs? Who are the heirs?
That's what I say when I give readings. I tell them that the biggest, the most complicated, to deal with are the recently dead.
Yeah,
okay?
Right.
You like the long dead or the living ones, but the recently dead for so many reasons because of what you say and how do we find this and who has it, and if you do find them, they're especially some of the lesser writers. Their heirs think that they're more important than they are, because you're looking for them, you know.
Right.
So that's problematic. And
So
you have to start looking for those executors if you can find them.
That's the word I was looking for.
And we found them all except for Lillian Hellman, like I said. And then the people like Richard Ford, who, you know, I wrote him and he just said, absolutely no problem, or called him. And you know, I mean, he was just so generous and with his work.
Well, we had, I found this book by a woman from Northeast Louisiana near Bastrop.
Up near the state line, yeah.
Yeah, her name is Maud File Zimmer, but she had done her writing in the 60s and 70s and been dead for a pretty good while. And I took to randomly looking up in phone books trying to find Zimmers. in that area, no luck. And Stephen,
what about her? What's her middle name?
Files, F-I-L-E-S.
That's who you should probably look up.
Well, you're on to something. Why don't you tell them you're part of the story, Stephen?
Oh, yeah, my mom and I, we used to have family up at Bastrop. My great aunt and uncle lived up there, daddy's aunt and uncle. And so we went up there, and I think we were looking over some of their old property. But anyhow, we stopped by the library. Morehouse Parish Library, and we've ran up on this little woman up there that's a short woman. She's one of the staff librarians, and we got to talking with her, and she was showing us some of the collection at Bastrop, which led to our saying, well, Bruce and I need to come back up here and talk with her sometime. Well, before it was over with, I knew that this woman was from up in that area, and I said, well, do you know anything about a writer named Maud File Zimmer? She said, well, I ought to. She was my aunt. And I've got evidently some weird kind of a knack for ferreting out this kind of, really, I mean, it's no coincidence I write crime fiction and mystery fiction. And so I just, it was a hunch. And so this woman is her niece, and so she gave us the right to use this stuff.
Yeah, and the niece's name is Carolyn Files.
Yeah, Carolyn Files, exactly. And in fact, I've been knowing also another one of her cousins, so he is, you know, the nephew to Maud Files. I've known this guy for a couple of years now. He's an older fellow, so from somewhere, I think, Oak Ridge.
So much did she write?
The Fileses were local, but, you know, it's a great peek. It's kind of
that's excellent.
Written when she was a child, so it's for a younger audience, but also kind of a Mayberry-type vibe to it, you know, what it was like growing up.
There was another thing too. She put us wise to. We just haven't followed up on it yet because of so many other things to include in the website, much less to bring guests on. But Carolyn told me about a woman, and she showed Mom and me the book about a woman who is an Arkansas writer, but she's writing about Southeast Arkansas and Northeast Louisiana, that area up there. So what has come down to us in history is the so-called Bastrop Strip. It was involved in the Burr conspiracy. Well, this woman wrote a history, and it's actually a good piece of local history, and it's a thick, thick book, probably 300-400 pages. Mm-hmm. And she's writing about the settlement of Bayou Bartholomew area. And she's an Arkansan, but again, she's writing about Northeast Louisiana as well. And she's still living, but she's a local historian. So there's a chance I've got some contact information for her that I could, you know, reach her in South Arkansas and bring her on. But again, I wouldn't have known this had my mother and I not driven up to Bastrop, you see, and done some poking around.
Well, my family's from Shreveport.
And
we used to have a camp up right outside of Oil City on the
lake. Oh, yeah. Well, see, Northwest Louisiana is a place we need more stuff.
Yeah.
Shreveport's got a writing culture. They've got a doggone thing called the Shreveport Writers Guild that's been around since my mom was a teenager. Now, my mother's 95, and this Writers Guild's been around since 36, can you believe?
Wow.
It's one of the older writers' guilds in the state, yeah.
Well, you know, Hot Springs, my husband's from Arkansas, and we go to Hot Springs often in Fayetteville, and we were at a poetry reading in Hot Springs, and they said, welcome to the longest running poetry reading in the nation, and I said, and I just because the Maple Leafs have that distinction.
Oh yeah.
Here in New Orleans, and guess what they said? They said you closed for Katrina.
Oh my goodness!
Oh
that's
come
what I
on
said.
Now!
I said you did not just say that. I just said you did not just say that. I'm just
pretending
like you never said that. Can you
say
that?
Shut up.
I said it wasn't a voluntary closure, let me say.
Well, it wasn't really close.
Well, it was on hiatus. I mean, it was.
It was, yeah, it wasn't close. That's right. It was on a forced hiatus. That's right.
That's ludicrous.
That is. I know. So put a bad taste in my mouth. They also say prayers and sing Glory Hallelujah.
Oh, of course. Well, there are a lot of cafes and bars and stuff like that that close down in August.
Yeah, that's right.
In
that's
New
right.
Orleans. So, yeah. You know, the idea that just because it closed a few days, it discontinued, that's just kind of ridiculous. So let's get on into the 20th century. What are some of your high points of the 20th century literature?
Aside from, you know, the whole Faulkner crowd, Alma God Show,
right.
and Sherwood Anderson, but also, and Hamilton Basso and William Faulkner. But one of my favorite Eudora Welty's stories is No Place for You, My Love, about a trip that she made to New Orleans. Loosely based on that. And
right.
And then Tom Dent's Ritual Murder is a short play that is so topical today. In fact, I just saw it in the spring at the Gache Cultural Center. It's always staged down here because it's really an unbelievable piece about the ritual murder of black-on-black crime. The ritual black-on-black crime. That it happened, just sort of the hopelessness of young, particularly young African American men, and that they turned to violence.
Complete despair. Yeah.
Complete despair, fueled with alcohol, and absolutely no way out, and no advancement, and no way to take care of their family. That they just turned to violence, and
it's hell on earth in a way.
It is. It is. But the character talks about, I don't see anybody on TV that looks like me. I don't see anybody, that has the problems I do. And, that we're fucked, I think he says. And he and his best friend get in a fight, and they're drunk, and he pulls a knife and stabs him. And it's just, and it really resonates with so many readers, black and white, down here, and with those who it doesn't resonate with, it needs to, because it shows you still the problem when you can't take care of your family or even contribute to taking care of your family, then and not necessarily through any fault of your own, and you've seen this as a generational thing, then it is hopeless.
And you do feel as though, too, that you can't contribute to the larger community. I mean, there's a sense, again, that you're not human, basically. I mean, that's the
right.
feeling that has to finally rest in somebody's soul, is that I'm not human.
Well, if you remember the anti-New Orleans propaganda that started circulating, especially after Katrina, that they were basically calling the people of New Orleans, who had gotten left behind and the government had collapsed and failed to help, they're a bunch of animals down there.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that, these horrible, horrible gangs that were looting, well, mostly they were getting water and food to take back to the dome so that the people who were stuck in there would have something to eat and drink,
Well, I was here. I mean, we stayed,
and
I was here for 3 days, and we had a boat. We stole my neighbor's boat. We broke into the ex-wife's house, and we stole our friend's car. And But I was here, and people were apologizing to us for stealing from stores that had insurance, and the food was going to rot.
Right. I mean,
okay.
That food would
and
never
I
be
said,
stolen.
And I said, don't even think about it. You are not stealing. Okay? And it had babies.
That language that Bruce was citing, that echoes
right.
the same language that nations use when they go to war, and you have to portray the enemy as basically as monsters. They're not people
right.
anymore. They're
exactly.
these monstrous creatures. And why? Well, if you portray them as monsters, then it's easy to kill them.
Well, there were pictures
yeah.
in newspapers that would show black people carrying loads of bread out of a store, and it was black
right.
people looting our residents looting, and then there would be white people carrying the same bag of
taking care of their children. Yeah,
they were foraging. They were foraging
yeah, right.
food, and
truth. Yeah.
It's like it foreshadowed Black Lives Matter as a movement by 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Everything
yeah.
that Black Lives Matter is talking about is right there at Katrina. Only we weren't paying attention.
Well, even you remember recently that when that baby fell into the gorilla cage and was and they shot the gorilla. That everybody attacked the mother, and then when the kid was the African American mother, and then when the kid was eaten by the alligator, it was the poor family.
However, right. Oh, right.
You know, I mean,
it was very racial.
I know, and people just don't see it. So that I end with Fatima Sheikh, another Creole writer, her story Climbing Monkey Hill. It's a coming of age story at the point of desegregation, and she, in fact, in real life, Fatima Sheikh was the first African American to attend Dominican High School. And so she writes a really great short story. It's online too. It's available online for $5, I think, purchase. But,
oh, wow.
And she comes down here often, so she comes to my class, so that's really great.
Oh, wow. That is awesome.
Mm-hmm. It's awesome.
That really brings it home, I think, to students when the instructor or professor can bring in one of those writers and see that, you know, this is not just words on a page. This is somebody who's pouring out their heart and soul on that page.
Yeah.
I'm teaching an epics class this fall, and, of course, we have Gilgamesh and Homer and Virgil, but we're ending up with the Lei Lauri Horror, which is a Dante. You know, it's written in the style of Dante.
Oh, about, Jennifer's
yeah, name? Yeah. Jennifer, what's her last name?
Reeser.
Reeser, yes. Which is set at the Lei Lauri House in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
It's a brand new epic, full epic tradition.
By a Louisiana writer.
Yeah. But she sets it as she's a Creole woman, you know, mixed race, and she falls in, because she's local, but she falls in with this tour group for some reason, like Dante, kind of lost, and they go into the house, and she starts seeing the ghosts of the past. Madame Lei Lauri, and I think Papa Legba, and then the people that were tortured there, and it's a very, you know, it's very rooted in New Orleans history, but also in Western traditions, and I like to be able to bring it home for my classes if I can, you know, have some bit of, yes, we're in this tradition too. We're part of that.
Right, exactly.
And she comes on, like, she doesn't visit, but it's an online class, so she gets online with the student.
Great.
Very generous with her time.
Oh, you're going to have Jennifer come on as kind of a guest or whatever? And...
Yeah, last time she did a Q&A with the students, and I'm going to ask if she'll do that this time too. She's always been very willing to do it. And then, like, the week that book came out was the week that American Horror Story New Orleans. everybody was looking up Madame Lei Lauri. I told her.
Well, you know, really, I mean, for a small school, our alma mater, mine and Bruce's alma mater, Tech, Louisiana Tech, has begun over the past, say, 10, 15 years, bringing in some pretty important Louisiana writers. And so we brought in, you know, here a couple years ago, brought in Daryl Bork, you know, the great Cajun poet and former poet laureate of the
poet
state.
Poet laureate, yeah.
Absolutely. And we brought in some other people, too. And we've
Didn't we have Julie? Julie
I think so. And also your colleague.
Now, Julie and I
colleague.
Went to school together.
She okay.
She was with us at LSU. Julie was.
Do you have any
got...
of her poems in your book?
I don't. No, I didn't go to the 20. I didn't. I stopped.
Oh, that's right.
But, mm-mm.
But we've got this up-and-coming young writer and, you know, poet and short story writer, Gennaro Keeley Smith, who's
mm-hmm.
teaching with Bruce, and he's got an interesting take on things as well. So, I mean, we've got some people, again, that they're trying to bring in, not just for the students, but for the community, so that they can go and really connect with these writers and learn about their literary heritage.
And, well, Jensen Ward taught at UNO for a minute when I was there. And then she quit so she could devote her work to writing, and which was a good thing for her. But I'm trying to get her on a panel at the Tennessee Williams Festival. But Moira Crone's also here, and John Bigby is also here. So, you know, they've come to my class before too. And Valerie Martin when she's in town.
Wasn't Moira a teacher at LSU, a professor?
She ran the creative writing program for a while, right when we were leaving and right after we left. But she and Roger have retired here
She's got some science fiction, futuristic, post-apocalyptic kind of she's written.
My husband published it at UNO Press.
Oh, wow, that's super
cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
put her in touch with us. Yeah, because it's some kind of a, isn't it set where New Orleans is now like an archipelago of islands or something or other?
Right.
But the odd thing about it is she started writing it before the storm, before Katrina. Mm-hmm. She's on vacation right now, but she's coming back soon. So I'll see her, but I will. I'll put her in touch with y'all.
Yeah, everybody leaves New Orleans in August. I can't imagine why.
Well, I left in July. It was the hottest July on record.
Oh, my.
I know.
I came down. I have to come when I'm off from teaching. So I came in late June, and it was hot and sticky, but not terrible. There was the first day we were there, it was the worst, and then we had a big rain that night. It was kind of cooler, but even more muggy for the rest of the week.
It's about to open up. The sky's about to open up, but we're fine with it. That way I don't have to water my plants and it cools things off. But when my husband was fired, we built a pool in the backyard.
Oh, yeah.
That's got to be a switch for him. You said he was from Hot Springs?
No, he's from Fayetteville.
Oh, well,
even further north.
I'm just thinking that's a real switcheroo for him, being from the mountains and go down there and all the humidity and heat.
He's been down here almost as long as I have, so nearly 40 years. So
he's acclimated.
He is. We both are. But we do like having a swimming pool in the backyard, I'll tell you that. And
he's been publishing
and working, but he's also working construction now, too.
Back to working poets. So we have some of Julie's stuff and some of Mona Lisa's. In fact, she's got a poem, I think it's Louisiana Log, but it's just a kind of a Walt Whitman-style poem about the various things we do in Louisiana. And I teach it with Sandberg Chicago because, like, I've been teaching Chicago for 25 years.
Mm.
I always wanted a poem about Louisiana that was sort of like that, and Mona Lisa wrote it.
That's the one she wrote. Didn't she read that over air for us a couple years back?
I've heard her read it.
Yeah. And she sings in it, too, doesn't she?
I don't know. I don't remember her singing.
I don't remember that.
I have to go back and listen to the...
Yeah, we had one of our recording segments. We went in with this class where Bruce had just finished up, actually, and we sat down there in front of a cafeteria-style table and talked to her. And she, I think that's when she read that particular one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that poem.
Oh, it's a great poem, and it's in, she let us use it. What we try to do with living people is, poets are great because you can put in two or three of their poems and then link to what they have up elsewhere so they can buy the whole thing. Because, you know, if it's older, we can put in the whole body of work if we so choose. Like Ava Isaacs Minkin, is that right, Stephen?
Yeah, the
actress.
Poet and actress,
She wrote a book of poems, and we recently put it, were able to include it in the anthology.
And celebrity.
She seems
to be America's first real big entertainment superstar.
And her poetry isn't particularly great, but it is, of interest for historic reasons, if nothing else.
There's a lot of that in here, as far as I'm concerned, in my book. some of it's not that great. That first play, I read it and I fell asleep three times. I said, how do I put this in here? I can't get through it. But then I decided to read it standing up. and it does get good, but it takes a minute for it to for the real action to come. And then the next play was Swashbuckler by Thomas Wharton Collins, the martyr patriots.
That was something we got into our website.
That was probably our first play that we put in the anthology. So do you have that one in your?
I do. And I wish I had Victor Sejour's the mulatto.
I was going to ask you about him because doesn't he become an expat too and move to France or something?
Yeah, he does.
Eventually?
In fact, I just went to France. I found a book on him while I was in France because I'm planning on writing something about him too. But he became Napoleon's secretary and friends with Dumas You know, he hit the big time too. He made quite a splash.
But the mulatto is
considered the first short story by an African American. So that's it still is.
It's kind of got that voodoo thing going and the Haitian revolution.
At the end, he cuts off his father's head, and the head keeps talking.
Right.
And keeps talking.
And it's like that scene from Star Wars, I am your father, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I'm your father.
So not only is he the owner, who's been this horrible bastard to him all his life, but then he talks about his father.
He saved his father's life.
Well, nothing like a little patricide.
Right. I'm gonna have to go. I have an appointment at 4. So
thank you so much.
Yeah, we really appreciate you coming on.
I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I feel like we could talk for another hour or more.
I know. Well, and also thank you for your service in making this book. You know, these sorts of things are always a labor of love. I think authors.
Well, and if you do an update, or if you when you get these other things ready to go, let us know and we'll bring you back on for a return
engagement. Thank you. And likewise, when your book's out, let me know.
We will.
In December.
Stephen, that's for you.
Okay.
When your book's out.
I'm sort of confused about half the time. Sorry.
He's got several more, but none of them are set in New Orleans until this one. So
yeah, this is the first one. In fact, I'm working on my sixth right now, so this last one was my fifth.
Whoa, okay. You're like Sam.
So, yeah, this time he's taking on a very famous 19th century, what is a forerunner to a modern-day supervillain type of character, and he was actually a villain in 19th century popular fiction, who's mostly forgotten today, but he was very popular at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century.
Excellent.
So hint to the listeners.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you. And the next time you come to New Orleans, let me know.
Oh, that would be fun. We'll get together.
I'd like to get a cup of coffee or a cocktail.
Sure.
Last time I came, I went on my first second line. So it was,
really?
Yeah, I had never done that. So they were having the last one of the season. It was hot.
It was an unbelievable
amount of weed, but it was great. It was fun.
That's good. Yeah, they're fun.
Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
We want to thank Nancy for stopping by and talking to us over the last couple of episodes, and I hope that you will, as you think about your book purchases for the new year, think about 200 years of New Orleans literature. A lot of people are enjoying just buying it and reading it from start to finish, in addition to all the people that get it for a class they're taking in the subject.
Yeah, read it for pleasure. I mean, this is part of the literary heritage of our state. And it's what we're doing in the sense that it's not something that's a museum piece or an artifact. I mean, these are, you know, we still have a very vibrant literary culture here in Louisiana.
Right. Well, for the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, I'm Bruce McGee.
And I'm Steve Payne. We want to thank you all for tuning in and listening to our chat with Nancy. We hope that you all enjoyed it, and we hope that you'll come back for next week's edition of the Louisiana Anthology Podcast. Bye for now.